Hey everyone, it's Tayshia.
What you are about to hear is a true story. It's the story of one young woman who started with a dream and a tiny harp and is now one of the most famous harpists in the entire world.
Plus, you're going to learn all about the harp, its history, its music, its pedals, which are actually pretty interesting. So just settle in. It's going to be a harpin' good time. And when you're done listening, or hell, even while you're listening, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review the podcast wherever you listen to us. Oh, and one more thing. I have to give a shout out. I was recently interviewed on another podcast called Tech in Art, which is done by a guy named Ward Holmquist, who's actually a conductor. And the podcast is all about the intersection of the arts and technology. It features lots of classical music people. Check it out. It's a cool podcast. And if you want to learn the story of my ascendance from regular obscurity to public radio obscurity, Ward got that scoop. And now, in the immortal words of Tone Loc,
let's do it.
There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the classical classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement. Oh,
I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical
music. I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Tayshia Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I am Tayshia Clay, and here with me today is the amazing Yolanda Kananassis. She is one of the most famous solo harpists in the world. She's performed all over the globe, and she pushes the boundary of what the harp can do. She is a proponent of contemporary classical music for the harp as well, and, you know, she plays the other kind, too. She's recently written a book called The Composer's Guide to Writing Well for the Modern Harp. And today, Yolanda is going to teach me all about the instrument. Welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thanks so much. So nice to be with you.
So first, I want to know a little bit of your story with the harp. Like, how old were you when you started playing, and why on earth did you start playing this giant non-portable instrument?
Well, that is a good point, because that is pretty much a defining characteristic of the harp. It is portable, but with difficulty. But the starting the harp was pretty much my mom's idea. I grew up in Norman, Oklahoma, and I played the piano from pretty much earliest memory. My mother was my piano teacher. She had just scores of piano students, and of course, that was in my future as soon as I was old enough to climb up on a piano bench. So I played the piano for many years and, you know, I guess showed a bit of promise with that. And I think it was sort of a combination of her thinking it would be good for me to widen my horizons and learn another instrument. And also, I really do think, and in later years, she actually admitted this, that I was developing into a bit of a tomboy. And I think she thought plopping me down next to a harp might refine me a bit. Or enhance my feminine delicacy. And, you know, it's funny because we all start sometimes our life passions in unusual ways. You know, I hear stories from so many people. Oh, my, you know, grandmother left my dad her harp, and I just started fooling around with it. You know, these random events that maybe are not terribly thought through. And, you know, I, in some ways, I kind of think the harp was one of those in my case, where I think my mother thought it would be nice exposure and, you know, she might be able to get me into a dress. And, you know, here it turned out to be my life's work and passion. Yeah. So when I was about 9, We took a trip to Chicago, actually, and this was kind of part of it as well. And we had to visit the huge, big music store in Chicago. At the time, it was Lyon and Healy. Now, Lyon and Healy makes only harps. But at the time, it was like a giant music department store. And of course, we had to go. And it was Valentine's Day weekend. So I would imagine that heavenly cupids and hearts and, you know, love and passion thing was their theme for their front display window. And it was just full of harps. And I think my mom was really fascinated by it. And I was somewhat, but I mean, as you said in the very beginning, you know, it's an impractical thing. I don't think at that age it would have ever occurred to me, oh gosh, you know, I think I'll learn to play one of those. But I think it took my mom by storm enough that she ordered me just a very little harp. They're called troubadour harps, and Lyon and Healy still makes them. And they're little harps that sit on the ground but have no pedals. So it's not nearly as much of a machine. And I think it's far less overwhelming for young students to learn on a troubadour harp because, you know, they're just getting the idea of plucking strings and getting some basics of the technique before they have to, you know, involve all their limbs in operating.
Right.
But that was kind of my story, you know, and I remained a tomboy even after.
Yeah, I was going to ask, did it work?
Well, you can ask the people who know me. I would say I did clean up over time, you know, in general. But, you know, I've said this a few times that I think perhaps my trajectory on this instrument has maybe made the harp just a tiny bit less angelic with me at it rather than the other way around, than the harp making me a little bit more of an angel. And, you know, I've sought projects that really highlight the power and the range of the instrument over sort of what we expect. I have recorded an awful lot of the standard repertoire for the harp, the beautiful French, the lush stuff. Part of it. I am not sort of concentrated on one niche that I don't enjoy and promote all the repertoire, but I would have to say at least the last decade of my career has really been honed in on the more contemporary, the more forward-looking, the, you know, promoting the instrument sort of into the next phase of understanding, I guess.
So what I'm hearing you say is that you may have started bathing more often, but basically it was you who changed the harp and not the other way around. So your mom's whole idea sort of backfired a little bit.
Well, you know, I guess I think that's sort of a common story of motherhood, you know, and now as a mother myself, you know, poor moms, you know, they try so hard. But no, I think, you know, the foundation that my mother gave me in the piano and in music. I mean, I am sure I read music before I read words fluently, and that kind of foundation in music, I think, was what allowed me to really do something with the harp, because the harp is hard. It is a complicated, not to even mention the logistics of getting it around and getting used to different instruments all the time. And, you know, all of that, it is physically a very challenging instrument to play, especially finding the right training and making sure you're doing it in a way that doesn't injure yourself and that really provides for the kind of volume and projection and range and control that you need. I mean, you don't have gravity even slightly going for you on the harp. I mean, if you look at a harp, it's like basically a big plane of holes. There's a lot of mind over matter when you play the harp. You've got to almost picture yourself having something concrete to really hang on to when, in fact, it's all a bit non-concrete. So, you know, it is an interesting mind exercise when you play the harp. Yeah. And so I feel like, back to what I was saying, I had an awful lot of great foundational training from my mom on the piano before I ever got to the harp. So the harp came quickly, where if I had just started out fresh, you know, my mom just stuck me in a dress and sat me down next to a harp at the age of 9, it would not have come so easily. So that in many ways, I was kind of hooked on the instrument itself before I kind of realized, wow, this is not easy. You know what I mean?
It was too late to turn back.
It was. It felt like I reached the point of no return before I realized, wow, this is kind of hard. And so I think it was good in a lot of respects. I think my life turned out probably about the way it was supposed to turn out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the history of the harp itself. Now that we know its history for you, where did this weird instrument come? And I'm sorry to call it weird. All instruments are weird, but like the harp is just, it's, you know, you kind of touched on this a little bit. It's a very unique thing. You know, when you go to see a symphony play, the harp always stands out when mm-hmm. when it comes out on stage. It's like, whoa, this is a massive instrument. Where did this thing come from? And like, what, I know there are lots of different kinds too. Can you talk about all of those things I just asked you?
Sure, absolutely. The harp has a really, really fascinating history. And one thing that I really love about it and why I have sort of pursued a lot of music from so many different cultures is that just about every culture on the globe has a version of the harp. And that whole idea of plucked strings, I think, was discovered very, very early on as something pretty fascinating to the ear. And really, the harp as a concept was introduced, you know, in the earliest of times. And it kind of started as a bow, like a hunting bow. Just a slightly triangular or arced frame with a string on it. You know, that idea, I sometimes have imagined, you know, what would that be like? It's kind of amusing to sit there and, you know, pull on a string. You know, hunters or people in ancient times just deciding, wow, this is kind of cool. It's sort of pleasant to listen to. Maybe let's add a few more strings. And from there, it kind of evolved and eventually the frame of the instrument became more reinforced to support more pressure from the strings. And really, it wasn't until the 1700s that folks really started experimenting with trying to make the harp more of a concert instrument. In fact, the Mozart Flute and Harp Concerto is written for sort of a precursor to the double action pedal harp that we play now. And, you know, to talk about some of the very various kinds of harps, the first harps that actually became slightly useful in a chromatic sense, meaning that you could change the pitch of a string as you were going along to incorporate different harmonies and different keys. You know, some of the earliest folk Celtic Irish harps incorporated like a hook and lever system where you would flip up a hook with your hand and that would raise the string by kind of pressuring it a little bit more, tightening it. And over time, that became very cumbersome. I mean, there are still lever harps all over the place. It's quite a popular instrument in folk music, and certainly Celtic, Irish harp. The lever harp is still used widely. It's a very different kind of instrument. It's not a concert harp that sits on the floor and has wide chromatic capability. But the lever system was important because it made people think, wow, we can raise the pitch and lower the pitch of strings as we're playing. And eventually it was decided to, I guess collectively decided, let's try and experiment with some mechanisms that will make it possible to widen the chromaticism of the harp. And that's where we got the pedals, which is what are used on the modern concert harp. But, you know, it's the harp has had quite a storied evolution. And, you know, like I said, every culture has had its offshoot of the ideas. The evolution I'm talking about is pretty much in Western culture, European countries and so forth. But, you know, it's very interesting how we got to this. And, you know, like so many things, some rather cumbersome experiments were created and then dismissed along the way. And so
I love the history of instruments that didn't quite make it, by the way.
It's so interesting. And, you know, you realize how important trial and error is. And one of the most interesting things, I think, is that we have two of the most gorgeous, iconic pieces in our repertoire, the Debussy Sacred and Profane Dances for harp and string orchestra. And Ravel's Introduction and Allegro. Which are just ear candy. They're just so lush and gorgeous. And I have the dubious honor of having recorded those twice in my career. And it's kind of interesting because I feel so tied to those two pieces. And I think it's very cool that I have records of the way I played them very early in my career. And then having recorded them again in the last few years, it's sort of an interesting snapshot of my evolution, in addition to, you know, how those pieces played such a big part in the evolution of the harp, because the Debussy Sacred and Profane Dances were written for something called a chromatic harp that had a string for every pitch, which meant there were no pedals involved. And harpists have always complained bitterly about the pedals of the harp.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like being a little bit of a machine operator at the same time as trying to be an artist.
Before we go on, I want to make sure that I'm understanding some things just a little bit, because as a person who has played music, I played the piano when I was a kid and I played the trumpet when I was in band. And then guitar, of course, in a failed garage band. But so I want to make sure I understand the terms chromatic and pitch. So can you describe what that means, maybe using the piano?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And that I'm glad you led us there, because that is the best way to envision how the harp works. When you look at a piano keyboard, you have both white and black keys. And the strings of the harp, when they are kind of in neutral position, and I keep referring to the pedals, there are 7 pedals on the harp, and they're situated down near the ground, down near the floor. And we operate those with our feet. And the pedals make it possible for us to play black keys on the harp, what would be black keys on the piano. So if you play a string, I'll play a C right here. If I want to change that without having to do anything with my finger, I can play that same string, move my foot into C sharp. I'll show you. I did that with my foot, not my finger. So that would be the black key right above middle C on the piano.
Got it.
So that is what makes it possible to play all this fantastic repertoire, because, you know, very few things are written in the key of C major.
Okay, yeah.
So, and the way that works is kind of hearkening back to that idea of hooks and levers. Through an intricate mechanism, when you push the pedal, there's a rod that feeds up through the column, the big impressive thing that you see in front of the harp. That's the column. And that leads to lines of mechanism that are in what we call the neck of the harp. And that's the thing that connects the column to the big soundboard of the harp. And in there, if you look up inside, it's kind of like a typewriter. There are all these lines of linkage. And it's a rather complicated means of doing something very simple, which is just pinching the string. What we want to do is just pinch the string, and the shorter a string is, the higher its pitch. So there's a position where the string is completely open, nothing is touching it, and then you move your foot into the natural, that would be the flat position. You move your foot once, moves the harp into the natural position, which would be the white key of C major. And then move your foot once more down to the sharp position, that pinches the string a second time and makes it a half step higher. So I know that all sounds very technical, and probably if I were listening to myself right now, I'd be glazing over. But
no, I'm riveted. It makes sense. I actually understand this now.
Well, you know, it's and there is a pedal that affects every single string on the harp. There are seven of them. So for every note in the musical scale, A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, there is a pedal that controls all the C's, all the B's, all the E's, etc. So what someone invented, back to talking about the sacred and profane dances by Claude Debussy, is somebody said, okay, we're sick of these pedals. The double action pedal harp had been around for something like 100 years by then. Somebody said, okay, enough with the pedals. We're over it. And they invented a harp, a rather large, cumbersome harp that had a string for every pitch. Instead of having to ever move your feet, there was just a string sitting there with the pitches you need. And there was even a program created at the Paris Conservatory in the chromatic harp. And they commissioned Claude Debussy to write a piece as the final exam for the chromatic harp. And as it turns out, the chromatic harp didn't really fly. It was used, you know, in limited fashion for a while, but it was still that old-fashioned mechanical double-action pedal harp that really endured. But what's great, that's the one we still use today, the double-action pedal harp that was brought into production early in the 1800s by a company by the name of Erard. But in response to this chromatic harp, I think it was a bit of a threat to the Erard company, thinking, you know, wait a minute, we've already taken care of this. And they commissioned arguably the other iconic impressionist composer, Maurice Ravel, to write a piece for the old-fashioned double-action pedal harp that had been around quite a while at that point, and that resulted in Ravel's Introduction and Allegro, which is another one of our just iconic pieces. So it was sort of like the Debussy Sacred and Profane Dances, an Introduction and Allegro by Ravel, became these sort of dueling pieces. And
it was like the Battle of the Bands.
Yeah, the, you know, archaic reality show, which works the best. And ironically, Debussy's Sacred and Profane Dances works beautifully on the double action pedal harp as well, and probably more easily done on the old fashioned harp. So, you know, we got these great pieces, but they are, you know, that little duel of companies produced two of our most amazing pieces in the repertoire. So, you know, that I'm very grateful for that experimentation with the chromatic harp, because, you know, look what we got out of it.
I love that story. I love that that's how those pieces came to be. That is incredible that there was a harp off between these composers.
That, a harp off. That's great.
All right, let's take a little break from this conversation for some words about our sponsors. This episode of Classical Classroom is sponsored by Maestro Classics. They're the creators of Stories and Music, which is this recorded series that they made for kids and families. It's won more than 50 awards, not to mention general adoration from the people who listen to it. It features the London Philharmonic Orchestra, and it takes those musical stories and it like brings them to life. It's one of those things where kids learn while they're having fun without actually knowing that they're learning. And there's an activity book that goes along with it. It's a whole thing. Maestro Classics just announced a brand new recording in this series called Bach and the Organ. It's all about J.S. Bach, who you may have heard of on this very show, and it tells the story of his life while talking about the pipe organ, which, P.S., back in the day, was the most advanced mechanical instrument that had ever existed. And you can learn more about this album and the rest of the series at maestroclassics.com, and, wait for it, you can also save 17% off of your order by using coupon code CLASSROOM. Yay! Hey, listeners, check it out. You can finally buy Classical Classroom merch. Yes, that's right. 7 years into making this show, we finally had the crazy idea to start offering Classical Classroom swag. If you want a Classical Classroom t-shirt, a mug, a canvas tote, sticker, lots of other stuff, just head on over to our website, find the Get Merch button, which is cleverly located next to the tip jar button, and you can finally be a cool kid. Go to classicalclassroomshow.com, click the Get Merch button, and hook yourself up. And now, back to my conversation with harpist Yolanda Condonassis. So what are a few other of the sort of fundamental, like, if you're a harpist, you're going to play, like, the repertoire, old school?
Well, there is a real core repertoire that, you know, spans the centuries and the decades, you know, the iconic harpist composers like Renier, Grangeny, Carlos Salcedo, all of those people were harpists and composers, and their contribution, you know, was immense. And, you know, we have others like Marcel Tournier, many of them either French or of French origin. And I would say that what one would consider the meat and potatoes of the harp repertoire comes from the French school, the French composers. Carlos Salcedo became associated with more of an American style, and he really went full on contemporary, you know, in his compositional career. But even he was of French origin. He was Basque and studied at the Paris Conservatory. So, you know, France was really that hotbed of interest in the harp in, you know, the earlier part of the 1900s. But, you know, we have wonderful repertoire since then. The Hindemith Sonata for Harp is an iconic piece in the repertoire. Of course, we have Mozart's Flute and Harp Concerto, which is, I'm so grateful for that. And that also has a strange story, too. Mozart had a prodigy, a student who just chewed up the harp. And at that point, it was a more primitive version of the harp. It was a single-action pedal harp. But, you know, this young student, I think she was 14, 15, something like that, he was inspired by not only her playing, but, as legend tells it, also her persona. That's a delicate way of saying that. And so he wrote Mozart's concerto for flute and harp, and he wrote it in C major, ironically, because that was the most feasible on, you know, the harp of that day. But he wrote it for this prodigious and apparently very lovely student of his, and her father, who was a flutist, an amateur flutist. But apparently there was quite a bit of uproar over his slightly undue interest in the young girl, and it's unclear whether the piece was ever premiered or paid for. But, you know, Mozart had a way of getting himself into hot water.
He did. But that guy was a mess.
He really was a little bit of a hot mess personally, but that, gosh, yeah. Know, thank goodness
but
for him.
Music.
What, I mean, what would the world be like without Mozart? But, you know, then again, kind of a slightly messy story that gave us one of our most iconic pieces in the repertoire.
You're like a big proponent of contemporary classical music, which I am also a big fan of. What are some contemporary pieces that kind of are like stretching the instrument? And because I know, you know, I think of like like, you know, what John Cage did with the prepared piano, where he took like a, you know, just a plain piano. And apparently, because he couldn't have a percussion instrument in the space, he like put stuff inside of the piano so that he could use it like a percussion instrument, sort of out of need. But like that led to this whole, you know, bunch of people doing crazy experimental things with the piano. So what's going on with the harp like that?
Well, the harp, you know, I often kind of refer to it as the ultimate sonic toy store. I mean, you just, it would blow your mind, all the cool things that you can do with a harp, with both, you know, preparing it and even just using your two hands and the metallic sounds that are possible with the pedals of the harp. And contemporary music is really something, I think I said this, that I've concentrated on just pretty passionately in the last decade of my career, because I think, you know, you kind of get to a point where you say, this is my passion, this is what, you know, at whatever point you are, I have devoted so much time and energy and effort to this. What could I do to really not just try and you know, master a lot of it, but what can I do to maybe leave things better than I found them? And I think so many artists get to this point where they think that, and then they kind of move into a different phase where, you know, in my case, I've commissioned a lot of music, you know, two major concertos by rather iconic composers of our time, Jennifer Higdon. I've just finished playing her harp concerto that she wrote for me. I think I just did the 9th performance of it a few months ago. And, you know, and it won the Grammy Award for Best Classical Contemporary Composition, which I was so thrilled for, and you know, got a couple of nominations. Yeah, it was a wonderful journey of bringing, kind of launching a piece into the world. And I have absolutely no doubt that this harp concerto by Jennifer Higdon will become an absolute staple in the repertoire. And that, just every time I think of that, it makes me smile, because, you know, gosh, we need repertoire that's not only really fun to listen to, but, you know, idiomatically written. And
idiomatically, what is that term?
Idiomatic, you know, in terms of instruments, means it's playable. It's written with a knowledge of how the instrument works, rather than, I mean, we have actually quite a mind-boggling library of repertoire for the harp, but I would say that a rather substantial portion of it is really not idiomatic, so it doesn't get played. And it should push the boundaries. It, you know, anything that is going to move an instrument, move a genre, move a, you know, a discipline forward, absolutely must push the boundaries. You don't want something that you can, you know, learn in a weekend. That's not what we're going for. But we need it to push the boundaries just to that outer edge where it is playable with a lot of work and a lot of artistry and a lot of mastery of the instrument, but it is not so awkward and unfeasible that the vast majority of people just say it's not worth it. It's not worth
it. I see. So there's kind of like a sweet spot that you're looking for. So you've got like some virtuosity that's necessary to play the thing so that it's actually sort of, shining new light on what an instrument can do and on what a performer can do and that kind of thing. But exactly. It's not so ridiculously over the top hard that it's basically unachievable.
Right. Right. Yeah, that, okay. You know, the person it's written for will be the only person that really takes the time to play it. And, you know, and I'm very proud also of the concerto that Bright Sheng wrote for me. It's called Never Far Away. And I played that quite a few times with a lot of different orchestras in the United States. And, you know, that one is kind of an homage to his, you know, his homeland, to China, and all the beautiful sonorities. And it definitely has kind of a, almost a world music, but very contemporary vibe. I think highlighting the exotic and almost global nature of the harp is an important thing to do, because it's a universal element. You know, it's right. Not just an American instrument, it's not just a French instrument, it's not just a, you know, European
Western
instrument.
Music instrument, yeah.
Right. It is it speaks to just about every culture, and for many reasons, but that among them the Bright Sheng's harp concerto was a wonderful project as well. But, you know, these things, you know, and there's a lot of solo repertoire for the harp too. A few years ago, I did an album called American Harp, and I thought that was important only because the harp is so often associated with, you know, that Western European kind of sound. And this was just wonderful music written by American composers, you know, like John Cage, and all original works. These were not transcriptions, you know, people like John Cage, Stephen Paulus, John Williams, the wonderful iconic movie composer, Lowell Lieberman.
Oh yeah, I'm familiar.
yeah. You know, and so being able to assemble a really beefy CD full of music written by names we know in the American compositional scene.
Yeah.
You know, that was important to me because, you know, obviously, even though I have this crazy long Greek name, I am, you know, about as American as it gets from a cultural standpoint. So, you know, that was an important project for me. But what we were talking about before, in terms of creating music that's idiomatic for the instrument, you know, it led me to write this book that came out a few months ago called The Composer's Guide.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, do you compose? So it's called, you were saying, it's called The Composer's Guide to Writing Well for the Modern Harp. But do you actually also compose?
I do some. I haven't really had the time to explore that perhaps as much as I might eventually in my career. But yeah, I have done a few things. A few of my pieces have been on records of mine, on CDs of mine. But, you know, right now, at least, my primary goal with this book was to create a resource, a very user-friendly resource, not a technical academic tome that, again, might cause people to glaze over and say, yeah, I know enough, I'll skip it, you know. But you know, this is just what, you know, my intent in doing this was to create a, you know, 100-some page conversation on all the different elements that are important to understand, and also just kind of good to know, kind of just a candid, blunt conversation about, let's get more right the first time. It's possible. You don't have to spend hours and hours and hours and days and maybe months on a piece of music for the harp, or even a harp part in a larger work. You know, you can get a lot right the first time.
You're kind of giving composers a place to start from. Is that
yes,
kind of,
yeah,
what you're doing?
Just,
okay.
Yeah.
So they're not starting from scratch. They have like some tools in hand.
Yeah.
To have
absolutely.
In mind when they're composing. Okay.
And another big part of the book is devoted to special effects, going back to that idea of the harp being this amazing toy store of sonic effects. And, you know, one big problem that I've encountered through the years is that we have no standardization of cymbals and special effect sounds. You know, we have one cymbal that can mean three or four different things, depending on whose music you're looking at. And then we have one sound that can be indicated in half a dozen different ways. So, you know, part of my goal, I had a number of goals with this, was to try and standardize the notation and the effects. And very soon a YouTube video is going to be coming out that, you know, is me demonstrating every single one of the special effects in my book alongside the symbol.
You have your harp there with you. Can you demonstrate what you mean by a special effect?
Okay, let me show you what something we call a pedal glissando or a pedal slide. Okay. Now, first what I'll do is I'm going to play a traditional glissando, which is the most iconic sound. And I hope this doesn't blow out our speaker. I'll do it kind of softly.
Yeah, that might be a good idea.
This is just what we call the most, you know, traditional sound on the harp, a glissando, which means to slide. And in this case, slide the finger.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a glissando. That's what we hear in every detergent commercial, right? But right. A really cool special effect is called a pedal glissando, which means to slide the pedal. And this is a very cool thing that is quite versatile. You can make it sound very edgy, or you can make it sound almost kind of jazzy. Let me show you the jazzy version first.
Okay.
And this might be the kind of cool end of a piece with a little bit of a jazz element. That would be kind of a pedal glissando light. Can you hear the sound of the pitch changing after the pluck? This would be a more edgy treatment of a pedal glissando.
Whoa. That is so crazy sounding. That's super cool.
Yeah, and all that is the metal of the disc putting pressure at the kind of the richest point of the ring. And you know, it's like metal on metal. That's what that sound is. So There are just so many things that you can do on the harp that it really was important to have kind of a user-friendly catalog with a really detailed description of how it's done, what it is, how you write it, and what it sounds like.
Yeah.
It was kind of exciting to think, gosh, you know, it's going to be so fun for a composer to just kind of look at this. Wow, it's like this giant menu. What am I going to have in this piece, you know? So,
yeah. And to have like standard symbols for it and things like that. That's like, I mean, it's interesting how musical language evolves in the same way that, you know, spoken languages evolve.
Oh, absolutely.
But it seems like musical language, I mean, like sort of it was standardized so long ago, but obviously because we have new repertoire, you know, we're demanding new sounds out of instruments, like it makes sense for there to be new ways of writing
right
out, you know, how to indicate to play the instruments. That's so interesting.
And I love the way you related it to the spoken word and vocabulary, because I'm super into words, and having the most interesting vocabulary. I mean, just like the great writers, it's not just the combination of words. It's having words that maybe we apply in a different way, or a word used to describe something that doesn't necessarily fit with that word. And that's what writing interesting creative music is, you know, combining pitches and sounds in ways, you know, we haven't heard before. We don't need to reinvent everything. We just need to combine them and exploit the vast spectrum available to us already.
Yeah, I kind of think about things like in spoken language, irony and especially sarcasm, and how writers have to indicate those things happening because they're such a part of modern speech, whereas, you know, they're maybe a lesser part of speech back in the day. And so I think about that sort of translated into musical terms, like,
oh, absolutely,
you know, the nuances of emotion, you know, that are contemporary, that, that maybe didn't exist for Mozart.
no, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And I am endlessly fascinated when I happen onto a piece of really fantastic repertoire at the unbelievably clear range of emotion that can be conveyed. You know, we can express humor. We can obviously express joy, you know, melancholy, deep, yeah. profound sadness. All that can be done through the language of music, which, you know, when you think about it, is pretty extraordinary.
It is. Well, and this has been an extraordinary conversation. Yolanda Kananisis, thank you so much for taking the time to teach me about this amazing instrument in the classical classroom today.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. And, you know, it's an instrument worth getting to know, I think. It sometimes has this kind of slightly off-putting, kind of elitist look about it sometimes. But I think there is no more earthy and expressive instrument, you know, kind of for the universal human soul than the harp. So I appreciate the chance to, you know, share some of it.
Spoken like a true ambassador for an instrument. Yolanda, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
All right, everybody, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more episodes, head to classicalclassroomshow.com, where you can find all of our episodes and ways to connect with us, even ways to support the podcast with your dollars. Don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review us wherever you listen. Thanks today to the home of Classical Classroom, Houston Public Media. Thanks to Yolanda Kananisis for being on the show. It was so much fun to talk to you. Thanks to the official quarantine uniform of Classical Classroom, pajamas. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.